Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Are we going to see members of Donald Trump's family using their positions to enrich themselves continually?
A lot of people speculating about Kushner wanting revenge on Chris Christie.
Kushner has a bold vision for the office, saying the government should be run like a great American company. And if they can't do that, run it like a Trump company.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the commander-in-chief who doesn't know if his naval flotilla is floating east or west, or north or south. Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. I think we're at the point now where the president's cluelessness and his dishonesty have formed a kind of perfect circle. The question isn't whether he was intentionally lying when he claimed that we were sending an aircraft carrier group to the Korean Peninsula, when we were sending them in precisely the opposite direction. It's whether he even understood what his military advisors were telling him, or even cared. The other great example this week was about the enemy Trump thought he was sending that carrier group to challenge. In an interview with his favorite breakfast television show, Fox and Friends, he referred to North Korea's boyish leader Kim Jong-un as the gentleman Bill Clinton dealt with. In fact, that gentleman was Kim Jong-un's father, a gentleman known as Kim Jong-il, or as George W. Bush liked to call him, Kim Jong II. That gentleman died in 2011. So how can you call the president a liar when he clearly doesn't know his jongs from a hole in the ground? On today's show, I'll talk to ethics watchdog Richard Painter about why he's suing Donald Trump in federal court.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Hey, TrumpCast listeners. Jason here, producer on the show. Just wanted to give everybody a heads up that we're adding bonus segments to TrumpCast just for Slate Plus members. The plan is to track ongoing stories by conducting follow-up interviews with favorite guests and friends of the show. So if you haven't joined Slate Plus, go to slate.com/TrumpCastPlus. And if you sign up today and you stick around for the end of the show, you'll hear me talk to Slate writer Mark Joseph Stern about Neil Gorsuch's first week on the Supreme Court bench.
My guest today is Richard Painter. He teaches law at the University of Minnesota. He was George W. Bush's top ethics lawyer. Now he's Donald Trump's top ethics critic. Richard, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much.
So this is just before we get into like the details of everything. It is a full-time job keeping track of the ethics issues around the Trump White House. I mean, it's just a welter of stories every day. How do you keep track of it all, and how do you get a sense of what's most important and what's a little less important?
Well, Jacob, that's what you guys in the press need to do. You need to really keep tabs of what's going on, because this is a morass of conflicts of interest. Every administration has a lot of conflicts of interest, but this one has more than most, because it's not just the president, but other members of this administration have not been divesting of assets that create conflicts of interest. And on top of that, you have all the foreign government entanglements, and of course, campaign finance and all the problems we've always had. So this is going to be a very, very challenging 4 years.
So let's just start. I mean, the original sin you just alluded to is failing to divest from his assets. There was a way Donald Trump could have dealt with this, right? Which is just sell his company, put the money in a blind trust, and be able to say that I don't benefit from anything that happens to that business I used to own.
Exactly right. Take the money, invest it in conflict-free assets, mutual funds, and government bonds. There are lots of conflict-free assets you can have. Or put some of it in a blind trust so the trustee can invest it in fancy stuff like the hedge funds or the private equity, but the trustee doesn't tell you about it.
Yeah,
so you don't have the conflict because you don't know what it is. But that's got to be a real blind trust, not these trusts they have set up here in the Trump family. Those aren't blind trusts.
Because, first of all, his family members are running it, and there's no way to know what they're telling him or not telling him. But you just got to assume that he's aware of it. And the people on the other end of transactions are obviously aware that they can be doing things that are helpful to him.
And, of course, that's what's going on. We have countries all over the world. They seem to want to, you know, give more trademarks to the Trumps. And the message is that countries all over the world are open for business for the Trumps. The Trump sons are traveling around trying to cut deals. And everybody's scrambling to be in good with the United States government by doing deals with the Trumps. And that's not right. That's not the way it should be.
And I guess it would be one thing if his sons really were off running the business, even if it's not, even if he hadn't divested it from it as he should. But they're on the lawn of the White House and his daughter is there, and there just seems to be this constant mingling of their personal business interests and public policy and public business, which I have to say it does just seem shocking. It's becoming routine, but it's still pretty shocking.
Well, it is shocking, and they should have had a clear separation. He could have told the children, the two sons who were just running the business, supposedly, that if they wanted to license the Trump name as their last name, too, they could go and run hotels or run whatever using their name, and they could make the money. But that money shouldn't be going to him. That would be going to them for using their name. They'd be associated with their services. You know, and I don't think we try to bar his children from using their last name. We hope they wouldn't be too tacky, but I'm old enough to remember Billy Beer when Billy Carter, Jimmy Carter's brother, was selling beer, and you try to control the tackiness factor. But the difference here is that the money's going into the president's pocket.
It's funny you mentioned Billy Beer. I mean, that's an interesting example. But the one thing, I mean, I was a kid. I vaguely remember that. But two things you'd say about it. I mean, one, that was a huge embarrassment to Jimmy Carter that his brother was off trying to profiteer on the family name. And I think they reined him back in. But second of all, that was a huge scandal. Like, Billy Beer must have been like on the cover of Time magazine as an outrage. And now, you know, that would be like the least bad of 25 things that would happen on any day in the Trump White House.
Well, yes, this would be like Billy Beer, but you'd be marketing massive amounts of beer all over the United States, and the money wouldn't go to the brother, go directly to the president of the United States. And then to add to that, people would just pay massive amounts of money to put the last name of the president on a product or on a building. As I say, I think any other president would have been impeached immediately for that. And the only argument used to justify this is, well, he was doing it already, so it has nothing to do with his being president.
What kind of overall ethics score do you give the last several presidents? I'm just curious, when you think about, you know, forget Watergate, but I'm talking about these kinds of issues about people profiteering from government service, nepotism, revolving door lobbying. I mean, if you look at presidents since Nixon, or if you want to leave Nixon out of it, since Carter, who was good and who was bad, and how much worse is Trump?
Well, I have some bias here because President George W. Bush is my client. I was the chief White House ethics lawyer from 2000 to 2007. But if I were to step back and objectively rate what these different administrations have done, I would say pretty much the same, except for President Obama had some noticeable improvements because of his executive order of January 2009 that restricted the revolving door, particularly between the lobbying firms and the government, and also other private sector entities in the government. So the executive order under the Obama years, I think, was a substantial improvement over all of the previous administrations, in recent memory. And I give him credit for that. The Trump administration is down in the new lows, I would say. And they've adopted executive orders a little bit like the Obama one, but has a lot more loopholes. But even though they have some restrictions on lobbyists, their position with respect to the president's own conflicts of interest, his family's conflicts of interest, cabinet members who have conflicts of interest, is so abysmal that I'd have to give them really very low rankings on ethics. And in some ways, this situation is worse than Nixon.
Huh. Well, elaborate on that. Why is it worse than Nixon, do you think?
Well, certainly the break-in we have here, we, of course, have a break-in, some of the Watergate break-in, but the break-in at Democratic headquarters was this time into the computers. And unlike the Watergate break-in that involved third-rate burglars who didn't even know what they were doing, this involves Russia, a country that has been trying to destabilize the United States, at least since the Russian Revolution in 1917. I mean, they've been trying to support fringe elements and destabilize our system. And only recently they moved from supporting the far left to the extreme right. But we clearly had a break-in. We've got a foreign power involved, a superpower, and substantial evidence that people close to the Trump campaign were involved or knew or cooperated with it. We don't have the information yet. And so at this stage, the Russia situation is worse than Watergate. Now, President Trump could fix at least some of the problem if he were not to do what Nixon did and cover up. If he were to completely cooperate in the investigation, make sure we get to the bottom of who helped the Russians, disclose his tax returns so we would know for sure that he isn't getting money from the Russians. He doesn't have a financial dependency on the Russians. But we have to get to the bottom of this Russia thing. It is extremely serious.
Now, I understand you are leading a lawsuit against Donald Trump. Can you explain what that's about?
This is a lawsuit brought by Citizens for the Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. PRU is the acronym for our organization. I'm the vice chair. The chair is Norman Eisen, who is the former chief ethics lawyer for President Obama. And we have brought a suit against the president in his official capacity, asking a federal judge to enjoin him from receiving payments from foreign governments and entities controlled by foreign governments, which are in violation of the United States Constitution. The Constitution specifically prohibits payments to United States government officials and profits, economic benefits coming from foreign governments to United States government officials. So this includes the bank loans from the Bank of China, which is controlled by the Chinese government, tenants in his building. There are foreign government-owned banks. Foreign diplomats stay in the hotels. They book the ballrooms and have big parties, and that's all paid for by foreign governments. And that's something that specifically the founders of our country wanted to prohibit. That's why the so-called Emoluments Clause is in the Constitution.
But I thought only Congress could enforce the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, and it can only enforce it against the president by impeaching him. I mean, how can you, as a private citizen or an organization, bring a lawsuit to enforce that?
Well, there are two separate questions. Who could enforce? And yes, Congress can enforce it through impeachment, which is a very, very ugly and political process. But also, if the president is in violation of the Constitution, a federal judge can order the president to comply with the Constitution. And we've had judicial review in the United States since the early 19th century when the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison decided that they would review acts by the legislature, by executive for their constitutionality. So the courts clearly have that power. The second question, though, is standing, which plaintiffs have the right to go in and ask the judge to do that? And it is true that not every citizen can go into a federal court and ask the judge to consider whether the president is violating his fiduciary, or his constitutional obligations. There needs to be some demonstrable injury to the plaintiff. We believe that we meet the standing requirement in the Second Circuit in New York, where we brought this case, because the case law does allow an organization which has a mission to focus on something such as government ethics, conflicts of interest. True's been doing this for 10 years in a range of different ethics issues. And what the New York case law says is that if you have to devote resources to a new problem that's created by the constitutional breach by the president, that you do have standing. And Crewe has had to devote enormous resources to this emoluments problem that is created by the president's unconstitutional behavior.
What do you want a judge to make Trump do? What could a judge make Trump do? Not receive money or give back money or make disclosure? Like, what would be the remedy that a court would order?
Well, the first thing that a judge should do here, and we're hoping that Judge Abrams in New York will do, is to find out the facts, to get the information about payments from foreign governments, from entities controlled by foreign governments, into the Trump Organization. And that includes bank loans and financing from sovereign wealth funds. Get all that information, that a lot of it would be in his tax returns, but he won't disclose those. Get down to the corporate level. These are companies that he controls. He discloses the fact that he controls these companies, but we have no idea what's going on with respect to financing of these companies and loans taken out by these companies and the rest of it. The judge needs to find out the facts, find out what money's coming into the Trump Organization, find out which of this money is coming from foreign governments and entities controlled by foreign governments, interpret the emoluments clause, tell the president what he can have and what he can't have. And if the president wants to appeal that order, or we appeal that order, we run it on upstairs, and there's a final judgment, could go to the Supreme Court. But then the judges would decide. These are judges with lifetime tenure. We're not Democrats or Republicans. We think that's a much better way to do it than through impeachment, where it's going to be a very political decision by Congress interpreting the emoluments clause when there's no case law interpreting the emoluments clause. It's going to be a very, very political process in Congress. We think it's much better for the judges to do it.
As you said, Richard, disclosure is at the core of a lot of this. I mean, Trump just seems not to believe that he's required to engage in any of the kind of disclosure that's been routine for his predecessors, such as disclosing his tax returns. But I was also really amazed by the recent announcement that they're not going to disclose the White House visitors log anymore. I mean, that's something that's become standard. Just the idea that you can know who the president and people in the White House, what lobbyists they're meeting with, that's all now going to be secret, right?
Well, yes, that's going to be the approach of the Trump administration. The Obama administration decided to disclose it. And that was in partially in response to a litigation brought by this same organization, Crewe, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, that it started under the George W. Bush administration. And the position of Crewe is and continues to be that this information should be available. Not every American gets to go meet with people in the White House. Indeed, well over 99% of the Americans will never get to meet with anybody in the White House. There's a tiny fraction of people, most of them either billionaires or lobbyists, who get to go behind the gates. We have records from the Secret Service as to who goes in and out. And we believe the public's entitled to that information about who these select few people are who are having this unique opportunity to influence decisions made in the White House.
Lastly, Richard, I wanted to ask you about nepotism. So put aside these issues about the business, about them not disposing of the business and not making proper disclosure. But if they in another world where they followed those kinds of rules, do you think it would be problematic that Trump put his daughter and son-in-law in such positions of authority and had them essentially running large swaths of the government?
Well, there's certainly appearance issues with that, and there may very well be a legal issue because the Congress enacted an anti-nepotism statute in the late 1960s. This was after the Bobby Kennedy appointment as Attorney General.
Yeah.
And the Congress specifically prohibited officials, including the president, from appointing relatives to positions in agencies they oversee. There has been some subsequent laws saying that the president has unfettered discretion to appoint who he wants to the White House staff. So there's a debate about whether the anti-nepotism statute applies to the president's appointments in the White House. The Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department gave an opinion on the last day of the Obama administration that the conflict of interest laws did not apply. The anti-nepotism law did not apply to the White House appointments by the president. This is very different than the advice that was given to me when I was in the White House. And to Jimmy Carter, who was told that he could not even have his son be an intern in the White House. So the Office of Legal Counsel has taken a different position on this. I looked at their opinion letter. I just don't know whether I agree or not. I think that one's a close call under the anti-nepotism statute.
Has your old office been politicized? I mean, George W. Bush, to his credit, seemed to recognize that he needed some independent legal advice on ethics issues, and he, you know, had you around to help keep him straight. I get the sense Trump's more likely to get a bunch of yes men, yes people, to tell him that whatever, to find a justification for whatever he wants to do.
Well, yes, his ethics counsel at this point is not getting off to a strong start. When Kellyanne Conway got in trouble for hawking the Ivanka merchandise on Fox and Friends, which is a violation of the government ethics rules, he wrote a letter to the Office of Government Ethics saying that the ethics rules don't apply to the White House staff. That's just flat out wrong. The Office of Government Ethics regulations do apply to the White House staff. That's what I told the White House staff, and same with President Obama's ethics counsel. So that position was wrong. And then they also tried to take the position that Ivanka could be just a volunteer and not be a government employee. And the reason they were doing that was to try and argue that the financial conflict of interest statute didn't apply to her. And they said, well, just as long as she's not paid, she can sit there as a volunteer and do all these official things. And they were going to give her a West Wing office, a security clearance, a lot of official work to do, and say she's not a government employee. Once again, that's just wrong. And we had to write a letter about that. There's a criminal conflict of interest statute, and you can't duck out from it by saying, well, the government didn't pay me for my work, so I'm not really an employee, but I'm doing all this stuff that other employees do. That will not work. So they've been wrong on that. They're trying a similar game with Carl Icahn, who they're trying to pretend isn't a government employee, while he's carrying out White House functions. So putting it all together, the White House ethics shop is in disarray and is not interpreting the law correctly at all. Fortunately, a lot of these people, such as Ivanka and Jared, they have their own private counsel, and those private lawyers are a lot better and more cautious.
I've been speaking to Richard Painter. He was George W. Bush's top ethics lawyer. Richard, you're going to be a busy man for the next 4 years.
I think so. I don't think President Trump's going to be calling me, but I'm certainly busy keeping track of what he's doing and what he's not doing to address conflicts of interest.
Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you very much, Jacob.
That's it for today's show. TrumpCast was produced by Jason DeLeon. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is managing producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of the Panoply Network. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.